Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, have you heard of the concept of rewilding? Images of great swathes of land being returned to their wild origins might come to mind, and you wouldn't be far wrong. But of course, it's an incredibly complex and intricately intertwined process, and one that we often hold misconceptions about. On Nightlife tonight, we are going to explore the delicate balance of restoring an ecosystem. How do you eradicate or control introduced animals? How do you reintroduce endangered ones? How do you manage natural resources on huge chunks of land? And how do you know which areas to restore? And what does it look like if it all works? Well, our guests tonight are Richard Kingsford. He's the Professor of Environmental Science and the Director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales. He's in our studio tonight. Hi, Richard.
Hi there, Suzanne.
I've also got with me Dr. Catherine Mosby. She's also from the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales. And Catherine, you're joining us all the way from Wilpena Pound in the Flinders Ranges. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon, good evening.
Yeah, you're not that far behind in South Australia, Catherine. Richard, where did the term rewilding come from, and when and where did it first start as a practice?
Oh, look, it originated in the US, a concept of sort of wildlands with some of the sort of giants of conservation biology, Michael Sule in particular. And then the idea was it focused on cores, corridors and carnivores as the sorts of things. If you captured the core protected areas, you connected them, and you had this idea that carnivores are the top of the food tree, then you could actually capture a lot of what was wild.
Okay. So why were the carnivores so important in that, and they're having the top of the food tree there?
Yeah, well, this is one of the most interesting things, is that a lot of rewilding is about bringing in the top carnivores, because they're the ones that generally get wiped out first. So, you know, we've seen lynx disappear from Europe, and a lot of the, you know, even our top carnivores in Australia have gone. They're often the things that we interact badly with as humans, and when that happens, a bit like your example of Yellowstone, you get the herbivores, like the elks, just having no pressure on top to keep their numbers down, and that's when you can start to lose an ecosystem.
Okay. So the carnivores are basically the most vulnerable to the humans.
They're the most vulnerable, and they're sometimes thought of as a sort of keystone species because they regulate what's happening. Mm. And there's a lovely video about Yellowstone called How Wolves Change Rivers. And it's about not only what do they do for the elk populations, keep them down, but it moves the elks elsewhere. And then how that whole ecosystem changes right down to the beavers in the river and how they change. So you get what's sometimes called trophic cascades, that once that predator comes in at the top, it has these repercussions all the way down the food web.
Mm. And I might get Catherine just to talk a little bit more about that too. So, Catherine, when people talk about rewilding in the community or in the media, are they referencing it in the right way? Because there is a bit of confusion sometimes about what it actually means.
Yeah, well, I think the concept has changed a lot over the last 20 or 30 years. So, as Richard said, it started off looking at cores, corridors and carnivores, but recently it's sort of changed more to look at trying to have large areas that can self-regulate and have minimal human intervention, and areas where we can have things that are natural, like dispersal of animals, and have that trophic complexity. So make sure you do have all those different levels in the system, and also areas where you can have disturbance. You can have large bushfires, or you can have floods and things, so that whole system can operate on a large scale, and that whole ecosystem's healthy.
And are there different types of rewilding?
Well, I think it's the concept that people sort of adapt to their needs. So, for example, in Australia, it's very hard to find places where we can do minimal intervention, because we have, you know, we've introduced a whole lot of non-native species, things like cats and foxes. So if we just sort of left the environment to itself, we'd be overrun with cats and foxes, and we wouldn't get any sort of biodiversity benefits from that. So that whole concept of minimal intervention doesn't really work that well in Australia because we don't have, you know, we have so many of those introduced predators, and a lot of the times we don't have our, or we can't reintroduce our top order predator, which is the dingo in Australia.
So, Catherine, in the Yellowstone example, was it as simple as here are the wolves, off you go?
I think there's been quite a bit of discussion and debate about how much of the change in Yellowstone has come from the wolves. So obviously the wolves reduce the elks. The elks spent less time foraging near the rivers. So they talk about the landscape of fear. So the elk kept moving, so they didn't sort of stop in one spot and really overgraze those areas. And so that led to a lot of riparian vegetation increasing, and they started to see things like songbirds increase. Even the river started changing, and they got more cold areas and shaded areas for fish. And things like the beaver have also benefited. But how much that's to do with the wolf and how much that's to do with sort of other management actions, sometimes there's a bit of controversy there, and whether the wolves are going to end up actually over-predating on the elk, and that might actually lead to, you know, a crash in the elk population. So it's still, I mean, I think a lot of these rewilding projects are sort of experiments, and we're continually learning about what works and what doesn't work. There is one example from the Netherlands where they tried to do a rewilding project there, and it failed miserably because they tried to put large herbivores back into this marshland, and they ended up dying of starvation because the area was just too small. They didn't have that connectivity and dispersal, and they didn't have any predators in there. So I think it's still very much trial and error and a lot of experimentation going on in the space.
Oh, fascinating stuff. So just still on Yellowstone for a moment, are the wolves getting to numbers that people are starting to say are problematic there?
I think it depends who you talk to.
Right.
Probably depends a lot on the farmers around the outside of Yellowstone as well. So, yeah, like I said, I think there's a fair bit of conjecture and debate about it at the moment.
Yeah. We are talking about rewilding here on Nightlife. My guests are Richard Kingsford, who's the Professor of Environmental Science and Director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales, and also Dr. Catherine Mosby from the Centre for Ecosystem Science as well. These two are colleagues, of course. Now, Richard, obviously Colonial Britain's got a lot to answer for, and anyone else who turned up with some kind of, you know, introduced species or predator. Can you put in context for us the scale of the problem that we have in Australia with all of these introduced animals?
Yeah, look, we've got a massive problem. We've got the world's worst extinction record for mammals, and we've lost what are called the critical weight range mammals, which are the sort of size that a cat and fox can feed on. And on top of that, we've obviously got lots of herbivores. From rabbits, obviously, that everyone knows, but we've got pigs, we've got deer, we've got camels, we've got horses. So as Catherine said, we've got an invaded landscape. And so the whole idea of rewilding, as Catherine said, is certainly changing as people adapt that way of thinking for all sorts of things. And more broadly, we think now about ecosystem restoration. And one of the threatening processes for biodiversity is invasive species, which we've talked about. Generally, people think about, you know, animals, but there are also weeds that invade. But then there are a whole lot of other, threatening processes like changing fire regimes, water regimes, land clearing. All of these, in some way, are changing our ecosystems. And sometimes, I mean, we've been involved in another project, for example, about reinstating flooding regimes to bring back the vegetation and the animals that were there. So as Catherine said, we're learning as we go. We're realizing that you can't just rely on nature to do its own thing, because we're living in the Anthropocene. Everything out there is being affected by what we do, and we can do lots on the positive sense as opposed to the negative sense in terms of restoring some of these ecosystems.
So if we just close off this top predator idea, that would be what, dingoes in Australia's case?
Or? Yeah, I mean, at some stage there were thylacines that did a great job, and you know, when Tasmanian devils weren't just in Tasmania, they were also around. And then, of course, the dingoes came, they were a later predator, and there's a lot of controversy about their role. So you find in large parts of New South Wales, you know, they're called wild dogs. They're not even acknowledged as being dingoes, even though, you know, the genetics shows that a lot of them are dingoes, but and they are having an effect. So up where we're working, Catherine and I, in northwestern New South Wales, Queensland has dingoes, South Australia has dingoes, no dingoes allowed in New South Wales, and you do see these quite stark differences in the different ecosystems depending which side of the fence you're on.
Okay, so what do the two look like? What's the comparison between dingo and no dingo?
It's a little bit like, you know, one of the other effects of the wolves going into Yellowstone is there was, you know, lots more coyotes that were running around eating smaller mammals. And in the same way, we find that dingoes will prey on cats and foxes and not so much the smaller animals. So you tend to find smaller animals in South Australia and Queensland, and less kangaroos. So we get huge numbers of kangaroos can build up in New South Wales because there's no top predator, whereas if you hop over the border into Queensland or South Australia, you don't get the same overgrazing effect. So you've got all sorts of changes. We did some work with a colleague of mine at UNSW with Mike Letnick, and a PhD student looking at changes in bird communities because there were more grasses in South Australia, so you've got more seed-eating birds in that part of the system than in New South Wales.
Wow. So the dingo does, in fact, have a real role to play here.
It does, absolutely.
Would you encourage New South Wales to allow dingoes?
Oh, look, I think that's a debate to be had. I think there's a lot of challenges in terms, a bit like, exactly, very similar to the story in Yellowstone. You know, we've got lots of issues around borders.
Mm.
So in Yellowstone, the wolves are getting out and killing some of the cattle. In New South Wales, you've got sheep farms on the borders of big national parks. And we know dingoes will cause damage in sheep flocks. So, you know, how do you manage those things?
There's a reason for the dingo fence, isn't there? Obviously. Yeah, so effectively, Richard, I mean, the dingoes are one aspect, but unlike Yellowstone, we don't have a specific problem in elk. We have that many problems and that many introduced species and pests that just popping some dingoes in, though, isn't going to solve all of our problems.
No, and you know, this is really about how do you rewilding, and we'll get onto it soon, but it in our work that we're doing is about bringing back some locally extinct mammals and then thinking about how do you let them exist there. We know that it's a very dangerous world out there with cats and foxes and competitors, particularly rabbits. So how do you make for the best way of restoring that ecosystem, sustaining those animals and getting them to do what they were doing 100 years ago, like things like bilbies, for example. And you can't just allow them to be there on their own because the cats will get them. So you've got to do this active management of building fences, taking out cats and foxes.
Yeah. Richard, who are some of Australia's rewilding pioneers? When did we start doing this in Australia?
Oh, Catherine's much better at answering that.
Right, Catherine.
Well, again, it comes down to what you classify as rewilding. So John Walmsley was obviously one of the first people.
Oh, of course. John made his famous
cat hats.
Yes.
Right. And he had very good success at getting animals to survive inside fences. I'd say Western Australia has done some pretty amazing work at rewilding over open landscapes. So more of that rewilding theme in that large areas and connectivity and things like that. So they've done a lot of aerial baiting and managed to get a lot of rare species, you know, improving over there, quolls.
Just on that, someone's just SMS'd in to talk about Cape Heron in Western Australia. Is that something you're familiar with, Catherine?
So the Perron Peninsula was a long, skinny peninsula. It was very large. I think it's over 1,000 square kilometres, and they put a little fence across the isthmus there and they did a lot of reintroductions into that area. Unfortunately, a lot of it, some of it worked, but a lot of it they still had problems with cats. So the one I'm thinking of that's really successful at the moment is Mutawa, which is further sort of closer to Perth. And there they've got bilbies back out in the wild over really large areas. And that's bilbies are great because they dig for their food. So you end up with all these foraging pits. They collect litter. You get increased carbon and increased plant germination in there. So they're what we call a keystone species where, you know, the impact they have in the ecosystem is is disproportionate to their numbers. So they provide shelter for other animals in summer because they dig burrows. The foraging digs trap the seed and increase the germination. So they're a really important animal back in the system. So that's been very successful over there.
Now, Catherine, as we mentioned, you're joining us from a rewilding site in the Flinders Ranges. Tell us about Bounce Back, which is the program that you're involved with there.
Yeah, so that's actually not my program. That's the Department for Environment in South Australia and Landscapes Board in South Australia, sort of been doing it for about 20 years. And the original intention was to recover the populations of the yellow-footed rock wallaby. But recently they've partnered up with FAME to reintroduce a number of species that used to be in the park. So that's the western quoll and the brush-tailed possum are the first two that they've been reintroduced here. So the quolls were put back around 7 years ago, and we're just trapping them at the moment to do the annual surveys. And yeah, the population's doing pretty well at the moment, which is great. But there's been a lot of intensive management from the department to get it to that stage. So as well as the fox baiting, there's also now aerial cat baiting. They do goat control, rabbit control. You know, there's a whole lot of management action. So even though that philosophy of rewilding is about self-regulation and sort of minimal human intervention and passive management, like we said before, it's pretty hard to do that in Australia. So the best thing about this project, I guess, is that it's unfenced and it's in over a very large area. We're talking over 1,000 square kilometres. So it's got the potential to have those key elements of rewilding, like the dispersal and, you know, allowing disturbance to happen and the trophic complexity over large areas.
So how big is the site?
So the park itself is about 900 square kilometres, I think, but they also partner with landholders around the outside to do fox baiting and cat baiting in other areas as well. So, yeah, it's a very large area.
Okay, and so how long ago was the introduction of these quolls and possums?
So 2014 we reintroduced the quolls, and 2015 was the possums. And, yeah, we're just starting to see now the rewards for the increased cat control. We've now got quolls dispersing throughout the park and possums are breeding up. We're catching lots of young possums at the moment, and yeah, it's been a really great partnership.
Yeah. So Catherine, is it important to prepare the area first, start up those baiting programs before you actually reintroduce the species?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's very few parts of Australia that haven't been, I don't know if there's any, that haven't been touched by humans or modified by humans. So I think you've got to do that groundwork first and work out what those original causes of decline are. And that's one of the first things for reintroduction is what was the original cause of decline? How can we address it? And before you even go ahead with the reintroduction. And in this case, it was foxes and cats. So there was a lot of work going into that space before you'd reintroduce anything into this country.
Yeah. So Catherine, much as the area is unfenced, I'm guessing it's also isolated. You know, the Flinders Ranges is quite a, you know, well-defined area. So if you're, you know, baiting across the whole park, can you in fact make a change for that area that is confined to that area, and you're not going to be getting new cats and new goats and new everything else coming in from the outside?
It's definitely ongoing. It's as I said before, I don't think it's ever going to get to the stage where you can just have that minimal human intervention. We don't have that luxury in Australia, and that's why a lot of people do build fences, because if you have a fence and you eradicate everything out from within it, then you don't have to have that ongoing control of ferals and things like that. But the problem with those fences is they have to be small because they're very expensive, and you cut off one of those key elements of rewilding, which is dispersal. So those animals can't disperse. They haven't got predators there, their numbers build up, they can overpopulate, overgraze the area. You also get genetic inbreeding happening. And you also, when you're isolating animals from predators over long periods of time, they start to become predator naive and they don't learn to live with predators in the long term.
Sounds a bit similar to the story with the koalas on Kangaroo Island, which are so inbred.
Yeah, well, they were introduced to Kangaroo Island. They weren't naturally occurring there, so their numbers built up to very high levels. And in the end, they had to do some sterilisation of them to try and slow the numbers down. So, yeah, even our native species that are put into the wrong areas can be invasive.
So do you do anything to help the species adapt in some way to these introduced predators?
So, yeah, we're doing that up at Upper Wild Deserts, which is the project that Richard and I are working on, where we're going to have an area that we're going to expose these bilbies and other species to very low levels of predators, and we've shown at Arid Recovery that that works to improve their behaviour, and also their physical traits change. So we've exposed bilbies and bettongs to cats for over 5 years up at Arid Recovery, and over that time we've seen the bettongs getting larger back feet, their skate behaviour is quicker, they're more likely to hide when they're foraging. And in the cases of bilbies, we've had higher survival of bilbies when we've released them into areas where there's cats. So there's promising signs that we can help train our native species to be more predator aware. And it may never be, you know, the silver bullet, but I think the more of these types of things we can add together with the predator control and the habitat, you know, just improving habitat quality, all of those bits of the jigsaw, if we can put them together, we can start to get this rewilding happening over large areas.
So I'm amazed you managed to actually see evolutionary change in a very short period of time.
Well, we're not sure yet that it's evolutionary. We have to actually do common garden experiments and things like that. But there's some of those changes could just be, you know, what we call phenotypic plasticity, which is just individuals changing and learning.
So they're working out in a sense and getting bigger muscles.
That's right. So what we're now testing is, are they actually passing that information on, and are they passing that bigger body size on to the next generation? And if we can get that accelerated selection, then we can start to sort of push it in the direction that we want it to go.
Yeah. So for Project Bounce Back in the Flinders Ranges, what's the ideal outcome? What does it look like?
Well, you probably have to ask the National Park that. I'm just sort of helping out with some of the research in the park, but I imagine that they would like to have more species reintroduced and also apply the results to their other parks throughout the state.
What other species could be reintroduced into the Flinders Ranges National Park?
Well, the Flinders Ranges was a very diverse area. It had really high diversity, a whole lot of animals actually completely extinct now, like pig-footed bandicoots and long-tailed hopping mice. But there are still animals like bandicoots, things like numbats, things like phascogales, that small bettongs that aren't here at the moment that could be potentially reintroduced. But, yeah, obviously these are long-term projects and require a lot of funding and planning to do.
Yeah. So how do you track the populations of the quolls and the possums when you're going to check up on them?
So we're trapping at the moment. We've got cage traps set. We've got about 190 traps set, and going out every morning for 5 mornings, and you capture them and you mark them, and you use capture, mark, recapture analysis to get population estimates. So we've also got cameras. So National Parks has got over 100 cameras set through the park, so you can look at detection rates and occupancy, and you can get an idea over time of how the population's going. And in the last 12 months, the population is basically the highest it's ever been since release, so there's certainly some very promising signs.
What kind of numbers are we talking?
Oh, we're probably up to, you know, several hundred individuals at the moment, and that's still a small population, but, you know, compared to no quolls at all 6 years ago, it's certainly going in the right direction.
Yeah, and so they're sustaining themselves then. They're certainly not going backwards, that population that's been put in there.
No, not at the moment, but there's obviously a lot of management going into keeping that population going, and I think these rewilding projects can be very expensive. It's not the same as adding walls to Yellowstone, because we have to do all this other management at the same time. We can't just add something and walk away. It's not that simple.
We are in the middle of a conversation about rewilding on Nightlife. My guests are Richard Kingsford, who's the Professor of Environmental Science and Director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales. His colleague, Dr. Catherine Mosby, who's also from the Centre for Ecosystem Science, is joining us. She's actually joining us from Wilpena Pound in the Flinders Ranges. She's just been telling us about the rewilding project that she's been engaged on there. And we're about to learn about the Wild Deserts Program, which you're managing, Richard, and which Catherine is a part of. Catherine just did allude a little bit to Wild Deserts, but tell us all about it.
Oh, look, it's a wonderful partnership, and it's really with the New South Wales National Parks. And they've established currently three, what do they call, safe havens, and they're planning other ones. But the work we're doing is right up in the corner of New South Wales, essentially sort of northwest of Tibooburra. And we've taken over the management of about 40,000 hectares up there. and we've been given the job of rewilding, if you like, with seven locally extinct mammals. So, you know, things like bilbies, western barred bandicoots, although they're called shark bay bandicoots now, stick nest rats, western quolls, golden bandicoots, bettongs, and Catherine, am I missing one? I keep forgetting.
Stick nest rats?
Stick nest rats, that's right. So, and the idea is that we bring them back sequentially. So we start off with the bilbies, which we brought some back last year. We fenced off two areas, which gives us an opportunity to experiment. And these are serious fences. They're 2 meters plus high with what we call floppy tops to stop the cats coming in. So they flop over the top on the outside. So if a cat comes up and it tries to climb over, it falls back.
Oh.
So they can't get over. And some of them have electric wires and very serious gates. And the idea is that we'll put all these animals back in there, breed them up. And the really exciting thing that Catherine was talking a little bit about beforehand is we've got what we called a wild training zone, which is where we're going to hopefully train these animals to get a bit smarter around predators. And that's a massive area of 100 square kilometres, which is also fenced. But we're going to look at having very low cat densities and fox densities, enough to sort of smarten up some of these animals when they get out there, but not enough to really dent their population so that we can control those numbers. And, you know, hopefully over the next decade or so or more, we can build those numbers right up so that, you know, we've got this massive area with these animals. And should I just say, this is not just about them. It's about the whole ecosystem. And we're expecting a whole range of different birds to come back, like ground nesting birds and other, you know, reptiles and so on. So, I mean, generally people think rewilding, furry things that are warm and cuddly, i.e. mammals, but we're talking about a whole range of other animals and plants here.
Yeah. I love this wild training zone. How do you actually expose, you know, your little mammal to a nasty cat? What do you do? How do you smarten it up?
Well, we know we've got nasty cats already in the wild training zone. So it's really about how many nasty cats can you have in there before you've got trouble in terms of the number of bilbies or the number of bettongs that you have in there. And the idea that you have a low level of number of cats, and I might get Catherine to comment because she's been doing some of this work with her colleagues in Arid Recovery, which is in South Australia, where they've been testing some of these thresholds.
Yeah, Catherine, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that we have had bettongs and bilbies coexist for, you know, many, many years with cats. It's about tweaking the numbers and making sure you've got low numbers of cats and large numbers of bettongs. So it's a bit like a recipe. You don't have a recipe for it. It's a bit of trial and error. You add some cats. You have to remove cats. We started off with one cat and nothing happened, so we had to add a few more, and then too much happened and we had to take a few out. So it's trying to get the animals to learn, and some of that will mean natural selection. So some of those animals will be killed by cats, but you want the remaining ones to be the smarter, you know, larger, faster ones. And so over time, the hope is that that population will then become a lot more capable of surviving with cats.
Right, but you are putting up sacrificial bettongs and bilbies.
To a certain extent, you are. But I think if you look at the number of reintroductions that have occurred outside of fences in Australia, where every single animal has died after reintroduction, and even recently, you know, there's still reintroductions going on where you get, you know, complete failure from cats and foxes. So I guess we're trying a bold new approach, and yes, we may have some animals that succumb to cat predation in the process, but at the end of the day, if we don't do things like this, we're just going to end up with animals stuck behind fences or on offshore islands, and you're going to have to go and pay money to see them like a zoo. So, you know, we need to be trying bold new things, and they may not work, or they may take 100 years to work. But if we don't start now, we'll still be in the same situation in 100 years' time.
But I think the good thing here is that we are getting better at managing cats and foxes. So we can potentially keep them numbers low and work out the techniques to do that. And that allows essentially if you think about it, we're manipulating the predator at the top, and we're being the predator of the cats and foxes, keeping their numbers low enough so that these herbivores generally and insectivores can increase over time. And it would just be a wonderful thing if these animals were able not just to stay in a training zone, but actually get beyond those and get right out into the wild and survive with low numbers of cats and foxes.
I suppose the good news here is, though, that you think it is possible that you can have a number of cats and you can still have the population
well,
survive.
Well, Catherine and her colleagues have already showed that, which is really exciting.
Even really susceptible species can coexist with a certain density of cats. You've got to find out what that density is, and then you've got to work towards trying to increase that threshold either through habitat manipulation or prey, addressing the prey naivety, or keeping the predator numbers down below that threshold through innovative feral cat control technologies. I mean, we didn't have any way of controlling cats at all until sort of 20 years or so, when Western Australia came up with a special, you know, sausage bait that was attractive to cats with 1,000 herbs and spices that worked, you know. So we're now got grooming traps, and we're looking at a whole lot of other ways of trying to control cats. But at the end of the day, we don't want to be sitting there killing cats all the time. We want these animals to coexist as much as possible. So what can we do to increase the prey responses? What can we do to make the habitat less suitable for predators? And cats like open areas. They hunt more effectively in open areas. If we can get that structural complexity back in the habitat by reducing the herbivores, if we can add topwater predators where we can, all those things will help.
It's interesting. I've always thought of cats as an urban problem, not a desert problem.
But they're a huge problem. And I guess part of the assumption here is we can't get rid of cats and foxes everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the great successes, broadly talking about rewilding and restoration, have happened on islands. Mm-hmm. So, you know, places like Macquarie Island, where there were cats and rats, Lord Howe Island, which had cats, pigs, goats, rats, mice, everything. You can get rid of them all and then have very strict ways of controlling them. But we're talking about the mainland, and in a sense, we're establishing islands within the mainland and then trying to work on invasion fronts back in across the landscape.
Now, the idea of the, the betongs and the bilbies living with the cats, we've talked about that. What about living with us? Is that, or is that just too much of a pipe dream?
You mean in like pets?
Well, no, I mean, you know, producing a landscape where we're not going to be impacting on their survival. I mean, I guess that's about habitat,
yeah,
really, isn't it?
And I think this is the broader question about, is this a panacea for biodiversity conservation? No, it isn't. Mm. We're essentially dealing with one of the major threatening processes, which is about invasive species, primarily cats and foxes. When you start to talk about other things like climate change, or you start to think about things like over-harvesting or habitat loss in terms of land clearing or, you know, degradation of rivers, if we're going to live with the biodiversity and try and encourage it back, we've also got to do some things about those threatening processes. And sometimes they're, even though, you know, the invasive species one is difficult, everybody wants to really get rid of cat. Well, most people want to get rid of cats and foxes in the wild, whereas most people do not want to necessarily stop, you know, big agriculture or mining, or not you necessarily stop them, but reduce their effects.
I'd imagine, maybe Catherine, I'll ask this of you, that this is very expensive. I mean, you're saying that it requires basically a permanent presence, baiting the cats or whatever the species happen to be that is a problem. One of our SMSs has just said, look, it's important that we mention that the taxpayer is funding these. Catherine, maybe you could give us a sense. I mean, I assume millions of dollars go into projects like these.
Well, it's actually interesting. A lot of the money that goes into it comes from private donors. I mean, you look at the Australian Wildlife Conservancy and Bush Heritage. Almost all of their funding comes from just philanthropic donations. So this is so governments, yes, do put money into it, but even the partnership here at, in the Flinders Ranges, FAME is a conservation charity, and that's all funded by private donors. So a lot of the money that's actually going to these projects comes from just, you know, mum and dad who want to help the environment, or through, you know, wealthy philanthropists. So yeah, we should.
And even our Wild Deserts project, UNSW has put a lot of resources, mm-hmm. both in terms of our research expertise, but also in terms of infrastructure. And also, you know, we also have philanthropic people who really want to make a difference. And this, yes, taxpayers are putting in money, and you know, a 10-year project like Wild Deserts is around 8 to 10 million. So you're talking about a massive change and an incredible conservation increase. But there are going to be windfall gains here. I mean, a lot of that infrastructure is built by local people. There are new jobs that are coming to these places. Inevitably, there's going to be a tourism trek out to these places that will spawn a whole range of different things and activities that we can sort of leverage out. So it's not just a hole for money, basically.
I guess on Nightlife tonight, we've got Professor Richard Kingsford, who is a Professor of Environmental Science. He's also the Director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales, where Dr. Catherine Mosby is also from, although she is joining us tonight from beautiful Wilpena Pound in the Flinders Ranges. Now, Richard, in Europe, they've been trying to rewild rivers and bring beavers back. How successful has that been?
Oh, look, it's been amazing. You know, they brought back, I think I read somewhere the beavers disappeared in about the 1970s in Europe or something, but they've got about 630,000 in 2003 in Europe. And I think they started to bring them back into rivers in England about 2015 or so. So, and again, a bit like, but a completely different ecosystem, they are keystone species. As people might remember or see wildlife documentaries, these big rodents with big tails for swimming go around chopping down trees with big teeth, and then they make dams out of them. And as soon as you put dams in rivers, it creates swamps, it creates a whole other ecosystem. So bringing them back into an ecosystem such as I think in England they were lost for 400 years, and now they're back and they're changing the way the rivers flow and a whole range of things.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. All right, and rivers across Europe as well.
Yes. Yeah. And there are other sort of big picture organisms are bringing back lynxes in different places. These are big cat-like animals. And, I think it's certainly a really exciting way of doing something very positive and achieving some great things.
Yeah. So thinking about all the rain in New South Wales at the moment, I'm assuming that has a lot of impact on water ecosystems. From a rewilding perspective, can it bring positive results?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, there's a couple of things. People might know I do a lot of water work, rivers, and it's great to see this rain coming. In fact, I was watching the news and the Paroo's in flood, which is the last free-flowing river in the Murray-Darling, flows down into the Darling. There's going to be water coming down to the Darling, which is great for fish kills and things. But even up in Wild Deserts, we've had this amazing 100 millimetres of rain up there in the last few days. And so there are frogs there. There's a wetland there that's a wetland of international importance. It hasn't filled for, I think, about 10 years or so. It's starting to fill. And we know that rain brings incredible plant growth, animal growth. So it's a fabulous place for locally extinct mammals to flourish, basically.
Now, Catherine, I might go back to you, because apparently you spent 15 years taking cats out from fence reserves and national parks, and then you started putting them back in again. Well, tell us about the background to that observation. What project were you involved with?
Yeah, that was the Arid Recovery Project, which is still going up at Roxby Downs in northern South Australia. And we've got 123 square kilometres of fenced reserve. And we spent years and years removing the rabbits and the cats and the foxes. And we added the bilbies and stick nest rats and western bar bandicoots and burrowing bettongs and all these locally extinct mammals. But, you know, after we'd sort of filled the reserve up with these animals, we tried to release them outside the reserve to sort of, you know, broaden the impact and the success. And every single time they were eaten by cats and foxes, and we just kept losing animals and we just couldn't get them outside the fence. So that's when this whole thing about predator training came in. So one of our exclosures up there, which is about 26 square kilometres, that's where we put some bilbies and bettongs, and we actually added a cat. And the first cat we added, I think we named them after composers, and he was called Mozart. And we put him in there, and it was a very eerie moment to actually release a cat into an area where you'd spent so many years actually removing it. And it was quite a philosophical discussion I had with myself about whether I wanted to do this or not. But I guess I'm very much about thinking about the big picture, and what we were doing wasn't working, and we really had to try something else. So old Mozart stayed in there for a few years and, you know, terrorised a few bettongs and bilbies and really helped to improve their anti-predator behaviour and change their whole physical attributes. So he did his job. Eventually he died of old age. So, it was definitely an interesting time.
Yeah. So what would have happened, Richard, if you'd popped a dingo in there as well?
In arid recovery or?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, I would imagine, Catherine, you could probably, but I mean, if that dingo found that cat, it would make, Mozart would have a shorter life.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. But would the dingo also be after Catherine, all the species that you'd been looking after?
Well, dingoes tend to go for larger prey, things like small kangaroos and wallabies and those sort of things. And the benefit you see in areas north of the dog fence, we still get animals like kiwaris and mulgaras and hopping mice, and you don't get them in many areas south of the dog fence, because when you add the dingoes back to the system, the dingoes reduce the herbivores, there's a lot more grass seed around, the dingoes reduce the fox numbers, they also have an impact on the cats, although not as much. And then, you know, you get that predation pressure release and you get what we call those trophic cascades. And we saw the same thing when rabbit calici virus was introduced into the arid zone. The cats and foxes declined because the rabbits declined, and that was one of their main prey items. And we saw this amazing, you know, 40-fold increase in distribution and abundance of some of our threatened species in there. So, you know, just manipulating that predation pressure even slightly can have this whole cascading effect, you know, down the ecosystem chain, and you can really get amazing change.
Mm. Now, we've mentioned that there wasn't really a successful cat bait available until about 20 years ago. But I wonder, both of you, what are your thoughts about using things like gene editing? I remember a theory in New Zealand a couple of years ago. I think, wasn't there an idea that they wanted to introduce it to rats and gradually make rats extinct by creating rats that couldn't breed?
I'll just have a brief comment on this. I think humans are wonderful about thinking about a sort of silver bullet. And genetics is often put forward as a silver bullet that will get something that means that all, you know, they've been trying this for daughterless carp, they've been trying this for mosquitoes, but generally it hasn't worked that well. So I don't know, maybe I'll get you to comment, Catherine, in terms of cats.
Well, look, I think they've looked at things like, you know, cat diseases and things like that. Hasn't been very, very helpful. But gene editing is becoming a pretty important tool. Like, we're already using it in some places. I mean, the American chestnut is one example in America where they genetically engineered the chestnut to be resistant to this parasite, or I think it's a parasite or disease, so they can actually get the American chestnut back in the wild again, which has nearly gone extinct. They're looking at doing the same thing with the black-footed ferret to try and get genetic diversity back into that population because it's so small and so inbred. So gene editing is really, we're on the cusp of a huge explosion. And I think the only thing that's going to limit gene editing is society's palatability for it and what we're prepared to accept and what's crossing a line for us. So there's certainly, you know, exciting things on the horizon, I think.
Catherine, what would be crossing the line for you? I mean, how would you feel about a gene that made cats disappear?
Well, I'd be quite happy with that. But I mean, it's the general population and the majority that you've got to convince. And I guess if, for example, New Zealand came up with something like a gene edit for possums to get rid of possums, and somehow some of those possums got over to Australia and started breeding with our possums and causing, you know, declines in our possums. So there's a whole lot of it's a really quagmire of ethics and international obligations, and there's a lot more work to be done in that space, I think, before you see it being
rolled
out.
Strong safeguards.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Australia has the advantage of being an island, but we are a very, very big one, which kind of means we lose some of those advantages. But, Catherine, Lord Howe Island has been a great example of a rewilding project. Can you just tell us what's been going on there?
Yeah, well, they've managed to eradicate cats from Lord Howe Island because there was the wood hen there, which is the native wood hen. They've also got a phasmid, which is a very large invertebrate that was really only found on one little rock off Lord Howe Island because it had basically been killed out on the island itself. So they have successfully eradicated cats there. They're now working on the rats, and the last I heard, that's going very, very well, and I don't think they've had any sign of rats now for some time.
15 months, yes. I think.
Is it 15 months? Yeah. So
they reckon they've killed 300,000.
I think it's a huge success story. But look at how much money was that cost to do. But I think, you know, the comment before about taxpayers' money, I think we really have to value. We don't value nature enough. I think it's really hard to put a value on it. But I think intrinsically we all need it, even just for the air that we breathe and the our health.
It's only a fraction of a submarine.
That's true.
And I mean, generally, you are working in areas with rewilding projects, aren't you, which aren't being fought over by mining companies and farmers. So it's not politically controversial.
That's right. True. And I think, you know, generally governments have gone for rewilding programs within national parks as well. And there are some advantages around that, particularly in relation to having that long-term protection and commitment by a government in rewilding and keeping that conservation going. Because back to John Walmsley, I mean, you know, that when he established all his reserves and floated the company, went broke, and then there was, you know, what we're going to do with him, and a lot of those got absorbed into the protected area system.
Mm. I wonder if there are more opportunities to work with farmers rewilding private land.
Well, Catherine, you can take that one, but definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people like David Lindemeyer do a lot of work in what he calls the matrix, which is we have these protected areas, but we have all these little patches of habitats that still are surviving in these agricultural landscapes. And if you look at the area, the cumulative area of those patches, yeah, they're really important, and we should be making more of those patches. So there's a lot of opportunity, I think, to partner up with agricultural organisations and farms to get that broad scale. Because one of those key elements of rewilding is just size, large areas, and most of Australia we don't have large uncleared areas left.
Those two things. Cores and corridors. So as Catherine says, large enough places but linked.
Yeah. I would also imagine to some degree it would be in farmers' interest. I'm desperately trying to remember the story, but I remember reading something a couple of years ago about trees in the Cooma area dying, and a lot of people were saying it's because the ecosystem's been completely destroyed, and whatever the little animal was that was actually burrowing into the soil and turning it over and making it healthy wasn't there anymore. So can't you sell it to farmers, you know, using a myriad of reasons that it's actually good for the soil and for them, therefore?
I'm not sure if it was Cooma. I think Monero plains have always been treeless, but think I seem to remember in the New England area there was a discussion about bandicoots and their role in terms of feeding on some of the larvae that might be affecting trees. And, I mean, there are a whole range of different things. When you take the biodiversity out, there are a whole lot of insect-eating birds that go as well that mean we've got all of these things that we don't, as Catherine said, we don't really value nature and the things that we call ecosystem services that we, you know, take as there all the time, like pollination, they will go as well. And suddenly you think, oh, what's happened to all of that?
Yeah. Have you got a lot of young people coming through the ranks interested in this area of conservation? Catherine, maybe I'll throw that to you.
Yeah, I think there's a real interest from young scientists and young ecologists to do applied science and science that's actually going to make a difference on the ground. And I think people realise, you know, we're running out of time. We need to be protecting our ecosystem. So I supervise, and so does Richard, a lot of students that are looking at this type of rewilding. And students also love getting out into the field and getting out into those wild places. I mean, they're pretty special. So getting the opportunity to actually work in some of these, you know, wilderness areas and these really remote places is pretty sought after by students for sure.
Richard, are there particular areas that you think would benefit from rewilding that maybe in your mind you thought, oh, that'd be a good place to do an experiment of this sort?
Look, I think there are lots of places where you could start to think about more active management and broadly more restoration of ecosystems. I think we've tended to go the passive route and say, let's put a fence around a place and call, or a figurative fence and call it a national park and it'll be there forever, and not really see what's actually going on there. And we're having declines in biodiversity in national parks as well as outside. And so how do we do that? And that means taking the sort of broadest definition of rewilding and then saying, how do we protect the biodiversity that's in there? And that requires a whole range of different management around the threats that are there.
Yeah. One of my texters is saying, look, can't you take your fenced area and just slowly expand the fence? I believe that was a concept that was brought up in New Zealand a couple of years ago too.
Yes, I think I can't remember what they've called it in New Zealand, but they have this one island or something where they're going to, they've got lots of these fence reserves and they're extending them and extending them over time. I mean, there are some real challenges, the fenced areas in terms of animals wanting to move in and out and plants and so on. And so it's expensive. And so potentially you could do that, but it would take a long time and be very expensive. And then you've got to make sure a bigger and bigger area has to be maintained.
It's complex, but fascinating to talk to the both of you tonight. Catherine, before we let you go, I imagine you're staying at Wilpena Pound Resort. Have you got beautiful stars or can you make us feel a bit envious?
No, we don't stay in the fancy resort. Oh. We're in the shearer's quarters, the old shearer's quarters. So not very fancy. I've got an outdoor toilet, but the stars are magnificent. So, yeah, absolutely wonderful being out here.
Oh, wow. Dr. Catherine Mosby from the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Hello, nice to be here.
Professor Richard Kingsford, who is the Professor of Environmental Science and also Director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales. Richard, thanks so much for coming into the Nightlife studio tonight.
Thanks, Suzanne. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.